Hello and welcome to Inside Education, the programme and podcast for teachers, policymakers and anyone with an interest in the how, what and why of teaching and learning. I'm Sean Delaney and you can download podcasts of previous editions by going to seandelaney.com. That's Delaney with two E's and just click on podcasts. This week I bring you the second part of my interview with scientist, horticulturalist and educator Sandra Austin about garden-based learning. Sandra describes herself as someone who is a deeply committed idealist who is passionate about the vital relationship between plants, people and resources and is keen to promote understanding and awareness of sustainability and social inclusion. She researches and teaches social, scientific and environmental education at the Merino Institute of Education in Dublin. Last week on the programme she told us all about her research on school gardens. This week she started off by outlining ways of introducing wildlife to a school garden.
You can make a pond from a basin. You just sink a basin into the ground. Like, that's the size. It can be as small as a little hand basin. Or you can make an insect hotel. It's another really nice project that is a great design project if you're doing designing and making in science class. Make an insect hotel.
And what is an insect hotel?
Oh, I am glad you asked me. An insect hotel is just a wildlife habitat that puts together in a small space a lot of different kinds of habitats for mini beasts and other beneficial insects that we'd find in our garden. Often they're built with pallets, but it doesn't have to be. I've seen them built out of old chests of drawers and things like that. It can be very small or it can be... I've seen a very big one that was called Buckingham Palace, which I think is a really good name. It can be collections of different things like pine cones or lengths of bamboo are really good for solitary bees. So solitary bees will go in either end of the little hollow bamboo stick and make their nest in there. Or there could be stones, which are very nice, or rocks. If you put some rocks in, that frogs or hedgehogs can shelter in. Or you can have, I would often stuff small little flower pots with straw or with shredded paper, and again there's lots of little insects that will make their home in that. So you're essentially, there's lots of how-to manuals available if you type insect hotel into Google.
And is there a problem with inviting insects to your garden that they may actually attack some of your vegetables?
There's always a trade-off, but generally you'll have as many beneficials or more beneficial insects coming than you will have pests, and usually nature finds its balance. So yes, if you suddenly attract a million aphids to your garden, lo and behold, you'll also have lots of lovely ladybirds and earwigs and other little lace wings and friends that come to feed on those. So biodiversity is always good. The more wildlife you have in your garden, the better it's going to be. You know, it's funny, I was talking to a teacher in a school there recently and he said our view as adults is so different from children's view sometimes. He had cabbages growing in the school garden and they were doing really well. And then all of a sudden the cabbage white caterpillars arrived in their droves and he was thinking, oh no, our cabbages are destroyed. And the children were like, hey, we've got caterpillars. So, like, and that was a whole opportunity. Then they followed the caterpillars through their lifespan. They put some nets over the cabbages so that the butterflies wouldn't escape. And then they follow the caterpillars through until they turned into butterflies, and then they let the butterflies out. And there's your learning opportunity. So what I as a gardener would think of as a disaster, as a teacher I'm thinking is a learning opportunity.
Is there a good time of the year to start working on this, or is it something that you can start at any time of the year? Like, is there work going to be done in the garden at all times of the year, or would you kind of say to someone, no, just wait till the winter is over and begin in the spring?
There's a typical gardener's phrase, actually, and gardeners are often asked, when is the best time to prune your roses? This is your classic garden. When is the best time to prune your roses? And the gardener's reply is, when you have your pruners in your hand. Essentially, the best time to do it is when you feel motivated to start. So if it's the middle of November and you suddenly get a desire to start something, there are things you can do in November in your garden. So you could plant some bulbs with the children. And if it's wet and miserable outside, don't plant them in the ground, plant them in pots, and you can bring them out in January, February. So yeah, that's a long way of answering by saying any time is a good time to start. There's something you can do all year round. And there are things that you can do indoors that then can be brought outdoors.
And for a teacher who doesn't have any knowledge themselves of gardening, how can they find out what to do, you know, in November or in October?
Again, I would refer them to the web, essentially, to resources like the Bord Bia Organic Gardening Resources. Incredible Edibles are also available on the web. Actually, GIY and Innocent Smoothies, they have a schools program at the moment called Sow and Grow. Now, that is very much geared towards growing seeds in your windowsill and getting things started there. But that's a good place to start as well. The first port of call, I find, is the web. Or pick up a gardening book from your library. Or ask a gardener, because they're usually very keen to pass on their knowledge.
And there probably are parents or grandparents in the school who would be interested.
Absolutely. And you know, there's probably even one or two closet teachers who garden but don't let on that they garden, and who may not have any interest in starting a garden at the school, which is fine, but who might be very happy to just
give advice.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And also, I'm very keen for teachers who would be interested in starting school gardens, get in touch with me. That's fine too, okay. And I can direct them to where they want to go. Because what I would love to do is begin to connect up teachers at different schools, to connect the teachers who are already doing school gardens and are happy to lend their expertise with teachers who might want to just get started.
And how widespread are school gardens in Ireland now?
From what I can tell, it's becoming more and more popular. There are a number of initiatives. There have been a number of initiatives. It feeds really well into the Green Schools programme. The Bord Bia initiative, I think, got people interested. The GIY Sow and Grow initiative. I'm finding more and more schools are beginning a garden. I think the issue might be that people struggle and then they give up and then they'll never go back again. So my desire, my drive is to make sure that people don't give up, so that if you're struggling, that you can find the support somewhere. Because there's some fantastic school gardens. The more I look, the more I find in terms of school gardens.
Yeah, that was one of the questions I was going to ask you, actually, was how do you keep up the enthusiasm once you get started?
Yeah, and I think the best way to do that is to connect with other schools who are doing something similar and swapping ideas, meeting other people and talking about that. So whether you as a teacher come to, there's a number of the different summer courses, you know, those, the DES summer courses for teachers who are interested in either getting started or just progressing. There are a couple of different conferences around the country specifically devoted. There's an organisation called SEED, which is the School Earth Education Organisation. And there are a number of different organisations have come together under this umbrella to encourage teachers and schools to do these kind of earth education programmes with their children. So connecting with places like that, I think that helps. That having that network, I think that keeps your enthusiasm up.
And are there any common pitfalls that teachers or children encounter in setting up a school garden? Anything you'd kind of say, oh, just, you know, this is a lesson you should know in advance?
One is taking on too much. So just trying to do too much. That's the biggest pitfall, but we've talked about that before. Also, knowing what there is to grow, and then so putting in stuff that you suddenly realise is not going to flower or not going to fruit until the middle of July. Not watering things, so not having the time. So think about, if you are putting in raised beds or anything like that, what is your routine going to be for watering? They're the main pitfalls that I can think of. Don't get discouraged. Don't think that it's a sunny weather thing. Be prepared to go out in all weathers. No such thing as bad weather, just the wrong clothes. Now, not necessarily going out in the pouring rain, but, you know, there might be chilly days. So being prepared, and the children being prepared, knowing that they have to bring their warm clothes and their gloves and things like that.
You undertook some research recently about school gardens. Can you tell me a bit about that research?
Well, yes, and I suppose we have been talking about it a little anyway, but my idea was, there's been a lot of research done on school gardens in the UK and in America, but very little done here that I could see. But I was noticing that there are lots of gardens, that lots of schools that are taking on gardens. So I wanted to find out what it was. First of all, how schools used their school gardens. Secondly, how they made them work, so what they did that enabled those school gardens to flourish. And thirdly, what it was that they valued the most about those school gardens. Because I recognise that it does take time and it does take commitment. So there must be a reason why these schools are doing that, why these teachers are doing that. It was a small project that I did. I interviewed 10 teachers across 6 schools, just around the Greater Dublin area. I tried to find a mixture of schools. So some very big schools, some very small schools, a rural school, so a couple of schools that were on the very fringes of the Greater Dublin area, as you might say, and then some very urban schools, just to get a feel for the variety out there. And in fact, the results that I found were really interesting. And I mean, I've said this to you already. The first thing I found was there is no one way to do it. There are a huge variety of schools out there and a huge variety of gardens out there, big and small. How do they make it work? There's support from the adults, so the whole school community gets involved, children and adults. Look for expertise, look for advice from outside. A lot of the schools were making very good use of the Heritage in Schools programme that's run by the Heritage Council of Ireland. So bringing experts in to work with the children. And that's really good. If you're a teacher who's a little bit nervous about getting started in the school garden, it's wonderful to be able to bring in an expert like that just to work for a couple of days with it. So that programme is a great programme. They also accessed resources, knowing how to hook in with your local authority. Local authorities are very supportive always. So they'll provide things like compost bins, they'll provide mulch and bark for your gardens. They'll often provide you with logs and things or spare bulbs, all of that kind of stuff. So hook into your local authority and also know how to enter competitions, as I said before. That's always very handy. What did they value? They valued that space for children to grow in, that kind of active hands-on learning. The gardens were a great place for that integrated learning across a number of different disciplines. But really what I found, each of the schools that I spoke to, they use their gardens as places of celebration a lot of the time. So each of them had either a harvest day or a garden party or an open day that gave the school an opportunity to celebrate various different aspects of school life. Whether that was cooking things that had been grown in the garden, or whether there was a scarecrow competition in one of the schools, which is a very competitive thing every year apparently, or just spending time outside with the children and having a space to come and invite parents to come and celebrate with. That was another thing that was really valued by the schools. Valued as places of joy, valued as places of learning, places of celebration, and that therapeutic healing aspect. So a lot of the teachers I spoke to were in learning support roles, and I think that was possibly for a number of reasons. One is you have a little bit more flexibility to work in a garden or to manage a garden if you're in a learning support role. But also that meant that they were very aware of that children who might be struggling or might have issues that the garden could help with. And that seemed to be, for each of the schools, the learning aspect was almost incidental. It was the social aspect and the therapeutic aspect that was really valued by them. For me, that was an interesting result that I hadn't seen so much in the literature. It is in the international literature, but not to the same extent.
And if you're looking for the literature, it seems to be under the title Garden-Based Learning, is that right?
A lot of the time, it can be school gardens, but garden-based learning, which I suppose is a very broad term that encompasses that kind of just hands-on experiential learning, using a garden as a tool. If you just do outdoor learning, that's a very broad spectrum of activities, and that can involve going out of the school and going to adventure centres and things like that. So to try and focus it down to just what you do with your school community in your school, I think garden-based learning is a good umbrella term to find that. Or school gardens is a good...
And is it necessary to have it in the school? Like, would you get as much benefit, say, out of going to the Botanic Gardens if you were nearby, or going to some local garden and...
I think there's space for that as well. So even if you're not going to grow anything in your school, to go somewhere close by. And I think proximity is an important factor. I think having somewhere local so that you're looking at something that you're doing in your locality is really important. And something that I think is really important, and it's easy to do when it's your garden, but it's not impossible to do if it's a garden that you're going to visit, is to make sure you bring it back into the classroom, so that it's not just something that you do outside of class, that it is part of your learning. So whether that's bringing food back into the classroom, or you know, whether it's physical stuff that you're bringing back in, or whether it's just that you're referencing work that you're doing outside when you get back to the classroom, to have that integration between the indoors and the outdoors, I think from a learning perspective is really important. The other thing that I think is a really good idea is to hook up with your local community garden. If you don't have a space in your school, there's hundreds of community gardens around the country now. It's a really big movement, that they will either come and help you, or that you could go and visit their garden and they may give you space in their community garden. There's often space for a school to have a bed or have a space.
And how would you find out about community gardens? These are not allotments now.
So the difference between, I suppose, an allotment and a community garden is that community gardens are usually gardened collectively. So whereas an allotment, you get your patch and you just work on your patch. There's much more give and take with a community garden. Yes, people might have their own patch, but there's also areas that are communal in their responsibility. Easiest way to find out where's your nearest community garden is go to Community Gardens Ireland on the web. At the moment, I know they're putting together a list of the community gardens in Ireland, but there's more coming online every day. So Community Gardens Ireland, or if you're in Dublin, there's a community garden. Dublin Community Growers is the network in Dublin. There's about 35 different community gardens around Dublin, so you can go there as well.
In the schools, Sandra, where you conducted your research, what ages were the children that you saw who were interacting with the school gardens?
They were all across the school spectrum, so from junior infants all the way up to sixth class. They would have interacted in different ways. So obviously, younger children might not have the attention span to spend a huge amount of time outside or to focus on a particular task, but they love digging around in the soil and finding mini beasts and planting seeds and watering. I'm thinking about aspects of play, you know, water play and sand play, all really important parts of the garden. And that moving up through the school, so that by the time they're in fifth and sixth class, they're literally growing their own fruit and vegetables. They're taking responsibility for, say, the watering routine, or for pruning or harvesting vegetables, or for building things to go in the garden. I think it's really important that children in fifth and sixth class know how to use a hammer safely, and a saw, and pruning shears, and those kind of tools. So working with hand tools, and thinking about the composting regime and how compost works, those kind of things work really well for fifth and sixth classes. And in the middle, third and fourth classes, again, it could be building your insect hotel, or again, working on your herbs and your plants in the garden. Children love making herbal teas. For example, one investigation that we did was blind tasting the different herbal teas that we made from the herbs in the garden, and then the children thinking about, what does that remind them of? Does it remind them of toothpaste? Well, maybe then it's mint. Does it remind them of lemons? Well, then maybe it was lemon balm that they had. Those kind of things. It works really well as an inquiry type of learning as well. You will find activities for children across the whole range of class levels in the school.
So I was going to move away just for a moment and just ask you, you're a scientist. If you were to make an argument for the importance of science, or even like, what does science contribute to a child's education? What is the argument for children learning science in primary school or in post-primary school?
There's a number of things, but curiosity, the idea that you're developing that sense of curiosity and that interest in the world around you. So that ties in with gardens and the outdoors. I think as adults, we are a better society if the people who make up the society are curious about how it works, how the world works, are connected to the world around them, so are interested in the weather, the climate, things like issues around climate change or sustainability. I think what science does is it enables you to critically analyse the information that you're getting. So we're bombarded with information from podcasts, from the internet, from the newspapers, from Twitter, all of the time. And to be able to make sense of that information, and to be able to assess the validity of that information is really, really important. We have the President of the United States at the moment talking all the time about fake news. His ideas of what constitutes fake news and my ideas of what constitutes fake news are very different. So I feel as a society, we need to have individuals within that society who are capable of making reasoned decisions and reasoned analysis. And that's what science does in some ways. It teaches you to question, so that not to take things at face value, to wonder why things might be the way they are, to think about how things might be better than they are. So it's that idea of never being satisfied with things the way they are. Make them better. Think of a better way to do it. And to understand. So to understand the world about them. And I think in that understanding, you learn to value the world around you. I know David Attenborough said it recently, why he feels it's so important that children connect with the natural world. And that idea is because if you don't understand something and you're not connected to something, you won't value it. And if you don't value it, then you won't protect it. And if they don't protect it, then who will? So for me, the two things are very strongly linked. Science and the natural world are extensions of each other or different facets of the same coin.
I have some general questions that I typically ask as well. So who or what inspires you?
There are lots of people who inspire me. People like David Attenborough. People who are enthusiastic and passionate about the natural world inspire me. Children inspire me all the time. The students that I work with who work really hard, they have a very intensive program. They're very responsible, very mature, very young. We ask a lot of them as students and they came up with some fantastic ideas. Teachers inspire me. I know it's a cliche maybe, but when I go and I see teachers working, I've worked a lot with teachers over the last couple of years as part of a STEM learning program for continuing professional development. And the commitment that I see in teachers, the passion that I see in teachers, inspires me all the time. What uplifts me is just stepping outside, going for a walk, getting out into the natural world. That regenerates me, that energizes me, that inspires me as well.
Any particular place?
Not really. Actually, the grounds here in Marino are incredibly beautiful. I love to go for a walk in the Botanic Gardens, which is just up the road as well. And I love to walk on the beach, which is a very different environment. That's just that idea that we are just one small living thing in this much bigger world. I find that a good detail to keep hold of, to recognize my place in this very impressive, inspiring world.
Have you a favourite book or blog or writer about education?
Interestingly, something I haven't talked about much is my interest in geography and geography education. I find there are a couple of geography writers or education writers in the UK who I find really creative and really inspiring. One of them is a man called Stephen Scoffham, and he's edited the Primary Geography Handbook. But he also is behind Teaching Geography Creatively, which is another book, which are very focused on field work and the outdoors and getting outside. So that's a whole other aspect of being outside that I find really inspirational. That's when I'm looking for ideas. I'll pick up anything by Stephen Scoffham. I will pick up and I'll read that. Nell Noddings, as a writer, is a woman who I find incredibly powerful. That whole idea of the ethics of caring and the relational ethics of the relationship between teacher and student, I think is central to my philosophy of education as well. In terms of science education, there's a Swedish educator called Hans Pearson who has a good blog, most of it's in Swedish, but he has some nice video stuff in English, around creativity in science and just encouraging curiosity and creativity in science as well. So he's someone else who I think is really good.
And finally, what from your own primary or post-primary education informs your practice in education today?
Lots, I suppose. I had a great teacher in fifth and sixth class, Mr. McCormack, who used to do what would now be called inquiry-based education with us all the time. I remember we built a working model of Newgrange that lit up because we had an electrical circuit in it. But he also made us write a novel, and he also used to bring us out to collect wild garlic to make garlic butter and things like that. So he was somebody who I found, and I find myself going back to the things we did with him all the time when I'm thinking about what I enjoy now or what the way I would like to teach now, or the kind of teacher I would like to be. I look back to him a lot. And I don't know whether that's, is that a part of being fifth and sixth class, that you're at an age where you're, where those things are very memorable, or is it that he really was inspirational, because he was. No, but those are the experiences. And I think a lot of what I try to do with the social, environmental and scientific education is to create those memorable experiences. So getting out of the classroom or doing something that makes the lights come on, or I think you remember those moments. And you know, sometimes it can be a bit of a cheat. I'm thinking tomorrow I'm going to be using a magic bucket with the students where you pour in red food colouring into the bucket and it comes out clear, and you ask them what they think is going on. And I know it's cheating because I know everybody goes, oh, wow! But it gets them thinking and it works, and it's a memorable moment. So.
Because you have bleach in the
bucket?
No,
I'm not going to tell you how it works. It's a magic bucket. You never know how it works. I'll ask you how you think it works. That's a good suggestion. But I couldn't possibly tell you if that's right or not. But those kind of things make it memorable. And that's what I strive to do in the way I teach as well.
And that interest in making education memorable came from Sandra Austin, who was talking to me about her research on garden-based education and other matters. Sandra teaches social, environmental and scientific education at the Merino Institute of Education in Dublin. That brings this week's programme to a close. If you'd like to download this or any of the hundreds of previous Inside Education podcasts, go to seandelaney.com/podcasts. But until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.